and Relationships, headquartered in Charlotte, serving clients in the U.S. and abroad. Details at dhgllp.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, we're all about art, the healing power of that art, and where art doesn't have the power to heal, the power of that art to erase deficiencies in a life. We got a couple of examples of the latter later in the program. I like that, latter later. First, the healing power of art. Hannah Blanton is a believer. This former registered nurse was stricken with a disease that left her paralyzed. Today, she has overcome that affliction, and she credits the restorative power that art can create with that recovery. But we'll let her tell her story. Hannah Blanton is the owner of Sozo Gallery downtown, and she joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Nice. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Now, you, in addition to being a gallery owner and a former registered nurse, I guess once a registered nurse, always a registered nurse.
Yes.
You're also a yoga instructor. So how do all these different, disparate things come together in one person?
I think the great thing about all three of these is that they all go back to healing. Whether it's being a nurse at the bedside with a child or teaching in a yoga class how to help someone to connect to their breath. And then art. Art's visually appealing and helps someone really go somewhere or just connect to something. Mm-hmm.
So before we talk about your experience with the healing power of art, we're going to have to talk about the condition that you recovered from. I don't even know how to say it.
It's Guillain-Barré.
Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Yes.
It's French. At what stage of life were you stricken by that?
I was 33 years old, and we had two children at the time. And it started actually on Mother's Day.
Wow.
And yeah, it's...
So just about... A couple of years ago yesterday.
Yes, 12 years ago, okay. Mother's Day.
Wow.
And it started in my feet and then gradually came up my whole body and essentially paralyzed
me. So talk about it. When you first got the first inkling that maybe you didn't even know something was wrong. I don't know how quickly or how slowly it comes on, but when you say it started in your feet, what was it?
It was numbness and tingling and just knowing that something was not right.
Mm-hmm. And did you know it that first day, or did you just think, well, there's something's going on down there, but tomorrow will be fine?
Yes, that first day I was just like, oh, maybe I had too much wine to drink last night, or maybe it was something in the food, stress. So we really just blew it off. Yeah. And then gradually it started coming more up the body. So physicians were ruling out cancer and all kinds of diagnoses.
And when you say gradually, I read yesterday that this can be very quick, or it can take a long time to do what it does ultimately, if it does paralyze you. It doesn't always do that, but it did you. So how long did that take?
It was about a week.
Really? That's fast.
Yes. And the doctors had a hard time figuring it out. But one night I finally got out of bed and fell flat on my face, and my husband had to carry me into the hospital. It was devastating.
I would think incredibly frightening, because you didn't know what was going
mm-hmm.
on. And a week, mm-hmm. I mean, to go from tingling or numbness in the feet to being able not to move at all in a week, what kind of stage did it, how did it stage itself as you went through that first week?
It starts off in your feet, and then it gradually comes up your body. And it started to come to a point where I couldn't even, like, twist the water cap off the water bottle. Mm-hmm. I couldn't... grab things, and it was a lot of pain. Some people go through a lot of pain with Guillain-Barré, so it literally felt like someone was ripping the muscles in my back. It was really, really painful.
Now, this is a syndrome and not a disease. I'm not sure the difference. Do you understand what the difference is? Because I don't understand the difference.
Well, it's an autoimmune illness, and it basically attacks all your myelin sheath. So your myelin sheath is what covers your nerves. Mm-hmm. So the connection from your brain to your nerves to tell your muscles to move, there is none.
Do we know what triggers it?
They don't, because it's such a rare illness. It hits like 1 in 100,000 people. They're trying to figure out more about it, but they have linked it to other autoimmune illnesses.
So at what point in time did they figure out what it was you had?
It was about a week, and one of the big tests that they do is a spinal tap, and once they do the spinal tap, it gives you the readings that that confirm a diagnosis.
Is there a cure for this, or are you fortunate that it came that you recovered from this, or is there something they can do for everybody?
There's not a cure, but they do give you IVIG, which is basically pure spun antibodies, and it takes those antibodies and gives it to you in the purest form, which eventually helps your myelin sheath rebuild. So there's not a cure for this.
Now, I know that doctors are said not to be good patients.
Yeah.
And you were a nurse.
Yes.
So you kind of knew what was going on, and you know the background. If they're speaking their doctor speak, you know what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So was it good for you to be a nurse in this situation, or did that complicate the problem because you knew what was going on around you?
I think it was good. I think it was interesting because my husband is a physician too. So okay. We would laugh a lot. I think it was good because I could be empathetic with some of the nurses knowing how hard it is to be a nurse. Yet it was hard for my husband because he really wanted to fix me, to cure me, and he couldn't. Hmm. But after that situation, I really wanted to go back to nursing because I knew what it was like to be a really good nurse, and I knew what it was like to have a bad nurse, and I wanted to go back and give my all.
So you went in after a week. How long were you paralyzed?
For almost 3 months, but at about the three-month mark, I started to walk again and eventually went home on a walker.
And when you say paralyzed, does that mean neck down? You couldn't move your hand? You couldn't twist a cap on a water bottle? You couldn't walk, obviously. What does that mean?
It was from my chest down. It really stopped, luckily, right at my diaphragm, so I didn't have to go on the ventilator. But, the worst part was just not being able to hold my children.
So this is a situation where not only is there pain because the myelin sheaths on your nerve endings are being eaten away by your own body, your brain receives fewer signals from the nerve endings. So you can't feel pain, you can't feel hot, you can't feel cold, you can't feel textures, right?
Right.
Does that go away slowly, or is it all at once? Does it happen? How does it happen?
It varies in every person, but for me, it started in my feet, and actually I still have no feeling on the bottom of my feet, which is pretty interesting and a little challenging in yoga sometimes.
You can do fire coal walking.
Yes, we've decided that if everything fails, I can join the circus.
So this is a ridiculous question, because I think anybody knows the answer to this, but if you're lying in a hospital bed and you've become paralyzed over the course of a week and you don't know what's going on, what goes on in your head? Mm. What do you think? What does that feel like?
It was a very introspective time, and a time where, you know, I think a lot of people can either curl up and die and just let it take over you. But from that moment on, I was like, I knew that this happened for a reason, and that I was going to try to do something with it and help others.
Happened for a reason.
Yes.
Have you figured out what the reason was?
I think I'm still discovering that every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Do most people recover from this, or do they not recover from this?
They say about 85% walk again, but there's a 15% mortality rate. Mm-hmm. And I do have local friends here in Charlotte that are still in wheelchairs. So.
Yeah. You credit, if I understand this correctly, you credit yoga, you credit being positive. And you say that art saved or healed you. Why do you feel that way?
That's tough. You know, yoga really helped me. It was the first exercise I was able to do after recovering.
Had you been doing yoga prior to this?
Not really, no. But it was more of the connection with the breath and my faith and just, you know, pulling myself out of a really desperate and depressing time and learning that I could use my breath and my faith and my breath with movement.
And what had been your connection to art prior to this?
The art part was actually a sermon that we heard from our minister at our church. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about a homeless lady that I'm very fond of.
This is Tatiana?
Yes, mm-hmm. Tatiana. She's a good friend. And he brought up the sermon about this lady who sold all of her art and gives all her money back to other homeless people And this was right after I had recovered, and it really stirred up a spot in my heart and saying that, okay, here's your chance. Let's do something with this. So we started the Carolina Arts Foray, and that was giving money back to the International Guillain-Barré Foundation and the Urban Ministries Artworks Program here in Charlotte.
Okay.
So that is really the part with art that started my healing and giving back.
So it's a psychological thing and an emotional thing and a spiritual thing.
Yes.
Not so much that it healed you, but it how would you describe it?
I think that through the
it
illness,
completes you?
It unveiled a lot of opportunities. And I know that when you go through something really tough in life, you learn a lot from it.
Well, I was going to ask you how you think this experience changed you, because you could not have come through the other side of this the same way you were before it happened to you. You have to be different.
Right. Absolutely. It's basically an awakening. And then just through passion and faith and really good people supporting you, it just helps you create an opportunity.
Now, the Charlotte Art Soiree that you started was really just a one-night thing or a one-weekend thing where you're selling art for charity, and somehow that triggered something in you. Because as I say, you were a registered nurse.
Mm-hmm.
You were not an art gallery owner. How did that lead to doing what you do today, which includes representing artists in your gallery and selling to people up and down the corridor here uptown?
We started the Carolina Arts Foray, and it basically grew every year. The last one we had at NASCAR Plaza, and my friends at Parkway, who run Hearst Tower, were there at that event.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually called me a month after that last event. And the Carolina Arts Foray, I think our last year that we had it, we raised close to $100,000.
Amazing.
Yeah, and we gave it all back to the Guillain-Barré Foundation and the Artworks 945 artists that sold their art there. So it was never in my plan to open an art gallery, but Hearst Tower approached me and said they had this great space with beautiful windows and light, and they wanted to talk to me about opening an art gallery.
I have several friends who've opened art galleries, and and they too came from careers that had nothing to do with art, and mm-hmm. I always think, that seems like a very dangerous thing to do,
mm-hmm.
open an art gallery if you have no experience either as an artist or in the gallery business prior to that. What made you think you could do it? It's a big undertaking.
I know. You should have heard my husband. He said, Hannah, we are medical people. We know nothing about opening a business. But, you know, going back to Guillain-Barré, I know that for me, God gives us these opportunities, and he opens these doors. And if you don't walk through them, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So how out of the blue was that to have Hearst Tower call me?
And I also read a story about that you were going to work one day early in the experience, and you thought, what have I done?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you ran into Tatiana,
yes.
The homeless artist.
Yes, again, and I don't believe in coincidence, but my father was just put in nursing home for Alzheimer's. It was a really, really hard time in our lives, and I was questioning our business decision, and I walk off the steps from Hearst Tower, and Tatiana is sitting there.
Hmm.
And I hadn't seen her in about a year, so I was like, okay, this is a sign.
Hey, I want to hear more about her, and we'll hear about the name of your gallery, because it has a special meaning,
mm-hmm.
in two different languages. And then we're going to meet two fellows who have done something extraordinary, actually. They're making a living as artists. Who knew you could do that in the 21st century? We'll talk about that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAB. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region, a North Carolina experienced hospice provider offering end-of-life care since 1978. More information at 704-375-0100. And Davis and Johnson and the Stars from the Equinox Orchestra performing the music of Savannah's own Johnny Mercer Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at the Community Performance Center in Rock Hill. Tickets at yorkcountyarts.org. The treatment of cancer is on the cusp of change, and part of that is coming from Charlotte. Several doctors at Levine Cancer Institute are involved in new clinical trials and treatments, among them targeted gene therapy, which allows for specialized treatment tailored to each patient's particular cancer. And that alone holds the promise of less debilitating treatment and better cure rates. We hear about many things revolving around cancer treatment changes tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, a look at the underlying causes of urban poverty and racial strife, how income disparity, government housing policies, and the decline of manufacturing affect the lives of African Americans in major U.S. cities.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about art this morning. Hannah Blanton is the owner of Sozo Gallery Uptown. Sozo has a meaning in two different languages, in Greek and in Japanese, and they kind of these meanings kind of coincide with what you went through as a person stricken with Guillain-Barré syndrome and with what you're trying to accomplish with your gallery. Did you know that before you chose the name Sozo?
No, not really.
Why did you choose the name Sozo? It's a weird name.
When naming the gallery, I thought, you know, it's got to have a fun name. It's got to have something catchy. So I really put a lot of trust in my prayers, and I prayed about it. And really, Sozo came to me when I was just reviewing some names. I'm right next to Luce, and I just want it to be uptown and fun. And Sozo means to be healed by God.
That's in Greek, is that right?
Yes, in Greek.
And in Japanese, it means what?
Yes, and I did not know it at all, but I gave the name Sozo in Greek to our marketing director, and she said, you're not going to believe this. She said, in Japanese, Sozo means artistic creative.
This is like Zen.
Yes. Yes, some people call it karma. I call it faith. It was incredible.
So I want to just, before we meet the two gentlemen who are sitting to your left and right, I want to talk a little bit about Tatiana, because I think that's an interesting story. And Tatiana is a homeless woman who is an artist, and she chooses to live the way she lives. Is that correct?
Yes.
You understand why?
I think I do. I've been friends with Tatiana for about 4 years, and she has taught me a lot in life, really. She's an incredible artist, and she gives back to people, and she's very happy where she is. So I just try to be her friend, and occasionally we do fun things like go to museums and look at art together.
What kind of an artist is she? A painter?
She's an abstract artist.
Abstract,
yes,
artist.
She does a lot of expressionism.
And you've taken your artist friends and gotten together with them, and they've given her art supplies to do her work. But then she sells these works and gives the money to other homeless people.
She used to. She's now decided that she does not want to sell her work, but she'll give it to you. But she refuses to sell it. She's funny. She says, Mrs. Hanna, I was rich and famous once in my lifetime before, and rich and famous only make you miserable. So she has a lot of depth, a lot of soul to her that I think we can all learn from.
Okay. Let's learn from two other people who are artists. Hannah Blanton believes in the healing power of art. We're going to meet two artists who experienced art in a way that's kind of filled a void in their lives, if I understand their stories correctly, and has led to successful careers as artists. Arthur Brothers had a physical condition as a child that he says kept him from being active at the time, but he spent time observing, seeing things differently, and after some twists and turns, that led to a career as an artist. And Kyle Mosher moved here from Canada. His future was hockey until a shoulder accident, I think, ended that dream, and he turned to art to fill the void. I suppose you could call that another freak accident, which has led to some very good things for him. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you with us this morning.
Thank you.
So you both have something in common, aside from the fact that you're artists, and that's the fact that these physical conditions, whatever they were, ultimately steered you to becoming artists. Arthur, yours started as a child. What does that mean? You couldn't go out and play with kids?
Well, I just I had some issues with my tendons, and I couldn't really, you know, run and jump and frolic. So I just did a lot of scribbling and drawing and coloring, and eventually upgraded to a pencil.
And and watching, observing.
Oh, yeah,
artists have
got,
artists have to observe the world and put their take on what it is they see. When did that ability begin to emerge in
about
you?
Five or six, actually, because that's whenever I was around the most kids.
Did you notice it, or did adults notice it in you?
I think my parents probably just thought I was weird. you know, because once I got to the point that I could, you know, run around, all I wanted to do was draw or color.
Now, Kyle, your story is slightly different. I don't know that you always wanted to be a professional hockey player, but I know you had aspirations at the college level, and that generally leads to things professionally. Was art a part of the picture all along as a sideline, or did it come later?
You know, I used to bring home drawings, that's really what started, I guess, my interest in art. I'd bring home drawings, and my parents would be like, "Oh, you didn't draw this," or so. I always had kind of a knack to render when I was in grade school, and that's where it really started. And I kind of dabbled with it up until I was, you know, 15, 16, and really stopped altogether at high school hockey. It's pretty competitive level, so I didn't really have time to do anything else but focus on hockey. So that's where it stopped, and it didn't pick back up again until I was probably 20, 21 when I stopped playing hockey.
Now, I have an acquaintance who's an artist, and he believes it does not require talent to be an artist. He doesn't believe that he has talent. He believes that anybody can do what he can do if you just put your mind to it and practice. Mm-hmm. I hear those words coming out of his mouth, and no, I can't draw a straight line, and I certainly can't draw a circle, so I'm doomed as an artist. So do you believe that, or do you believe that anybody can do this?
Yeah, sure.
100% agree too.
It's all about applying yourself and working hard to do it. So I feel like it's all about just making the time to do
but
it.
But it's not just the ability to draw. Mm-hmm. It's the artistic eye that you bring. It's the power of observation. It's what happens in your brain that turns what you see into what's on that canvas or that piece of paper that is more than just drawing a house with a dog in front of it. It's something different that goes on in your brains and between the connection between your brain and your hands that makes it artistic. Isn't it? It's not just hard work. It's not just sitting down and, by God, I'm going to be an artist. Is it?
I think that's definitely a part of it, is having the confidence to embrace how you view your art. Picasso, a lot of people don't know this, but when he could render beautifully when he was, you know, 6-7 years old, and he says that he spent his whole life trying to learn how to draw like a child, and he wanted to draw, like, you know, really naive lines, and so I think it's beautiful when people embrace and have the confidence to embrace their lines. I think there's something really great about that. But yeah, I definitely think it's all about, you know, how you view the world around you, and how you put that onto paper or canvas.
But isn't that where it comes from? It comes from your artistic sensibility. It's not just the ability to draw a picture. It's to draw a picture that has depth and meaning and art. I don't even know how to express it in words. And artistic. You can look at a piece of bad art and look at a piece of really good art, whether it's contemporary or realistic or whatever, and you know there's a difference. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to express it, but you know.
Well, I think, you know, more seasoned artists, they learn more about composition and balance and color theory and all of that. So, I mean, that comes in time.
So it's just math? It's just math?
It's a little bit of everything, really. But anybody can start.
So not many people are artists. There just aren't. You're a limited bunch. So were your parents, were the adults in your life supportive when you were children and teenagers coming up through this and becoming the people that you are today, the artists that you are today?
Not so much. My father wasn't. I got accepted into some pretty good art schools, but I always got the there's no future in art. And nowadays, they always say, you know, you should have done more about art. Or, you know, my parents, they'll see something on television where artists, they're at work and they're like, oh, you know, you should have done this program in high school or in college. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to say anything. But now they see it 20 years later. But I'm glad I took it in my own hands, because I don't feel like I feel like my path would have been different.
Kyle, I understand that you come from a sports-loving family. That they were not supportive of this?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely not encouraged, that's for sure. Same kind of story. You know, there's no future in art, and there's, you know, you'll never make money. And then, you know, I sort of believed that for a while. Pretty much most of my life, I believed that.
Then why pursue it? Seriously.
I let go of kind of what everyone else thought. And I really, I was, you know, it was like 22, whatever age I was like, this is about me. This is my life. And it's like, after I had, you know, all these injuries, and it's like, what do I want to do? What's the rest of my life look like? And it didn't look like a 9-to-5. It didn't look like working manual labor. It looked like this unknown, and I didn't have a clear direction, but it tied back to art.
Now, both of you have websites. I went to a lot of websites yesterday, but I know you have a website, and I on that website there are videos of you working.
Mm-hmm.
It's very intense, and I'm sure that when you work, Arthur, it's the same thing. Yeah, you're into your own little world, and you're starting from a blank canvas or whatever it may be that you're working on. There's nothing there. I've heard writers talk about putting that first, back when we used to use typewriters, putting that first piece of paper in the typewriter or opening up a Word document and there's nothing on it and they have to start writing. What's it like to start? Do you know what it is you're trying to do, or do you just sit down and it just evolves from that first thing that you do?
For me, it depends on the size of the canvas. I mean, if it's a larger canvas, I usually build them, and
does that mean?
I build them out of wood, so I go and purchase the wood.
Oh, so you actually make the frame and stretch the canvas. Mm-hmm. Okay,
so I mean, it's all a part of it.
Why is that important? Why can't you just buy them ready made?
I just like to put as much energy as I can into the pieces. I really believe that. The things around us, especially the things that we create, absorb energy that we put into them, be it, you know, good or bad. So I like starting from the very beginning, you know, not growing the wood, of course, but, you know, cutting it, gluing it, nailing it together. And then I prime the canvases. And while that's drying, I start mixing up my paint and just try to have a clear head and just make my intentions good. Because I believe that, you know, we pass on this energy with this tangible creative item that we're making for others. So that's sort of the beginning of my process.
Mm-hmm. Kyle?
Yeah, you know, I wish right now I had more time to be more explorative as an artist and more kind of, I guess, adventurous as an artist would be kind of the word I'm looking for. But I'm in a position where I create. I'm doing a lot of like commissions and stuff, so I always have like a clear kind of view of what I'm going to do, and I have this signature style that I've kind of refined over the course of the last 6-7 years. So I know where I'm going, and I wish I could break off and be more explorative. I wish I could break off and so I'm really trying to do that now. Is just explore and try new things, but. Being a full-time artist, you have to balance, like, you always have to pay the bills. So you have to create art that's, you know, that's for clients. But selfishly, I want to create art for me, you know.
Yeah. You're both very different. You have very different styles. So I'd like you to talk about your styles. It's hard to do this on the radio because people don't understand what we're talking about. And I believe we have links to both of your websites on our website at WFAE.org so people can go and see what we're talking about. But you're very different. So let's talk about that. You use, Kyle, a lot of, for lack of a better term, newspaper clippings and print material that goes way, way back. You somehow got involved with a Harvard archivist who gave you tons of material from back in the late 19th, early 20th century that you incorporate into what turn out to be very contemporary pieces. Talk about the process.
Yeah, so I was – inspired by synthetic cubism, which was a 1900s movement where Picasso and Braque were taking newspaper clippings and, I guess, applying them to a fine art field. And that's what inspired me aesthetically, that look of applying vintage newspaper. Or at the time, it was just regular newspaper, but it's vintage newspaper for me now. and putting lines over it and creating art. So that's what I was inspired by visually. And I guess taking that and melding the world of pop art, which is, yeah, for me, I think pop art's really derived and recycled. So I want to put like a fine art or a more classical spin on it. So that's kind of how, and the portraits were, I guess, the first thing that did it for me. And that's where it all started.
Do you have training as a graphic artist?
Yeah. So I did 2 years of graphic design.
Yeah. Because I think that comes into play here a little bit, not a lot, but some of your stuff is really, it's amazing. And to watch you work, where you take these pieces of newspaper and put them, cut them with an X-Acto knife in these strange shapes that just happen to fit the previous shape, and then you do whatever magic you do to them to make them portraits, is pretty work intensive. How long does it take to do what you do?
The first one was months of just fumbling and bumbling around and trying to figure out how to make it work. The irony is portraits were probably my worst thing when I was in school, was drawing portraits, but I kind of figured it out. Like, as soon as I started breaking it down to value and shapes, which is what I do with the newspapers, I break it down, I look at and I see the value in the shapes. Like, it just kind of made sense to me. But when I was trying to render it with a pencil or a graphite, I was trying to struggle through this.
So Kyle's work is very exacting, and yours, Arthur, is fluid. Mm-hmm. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, most of it.
So talk about what it is that you do, because it's color and fluidity, mm-hmm, and I don't want to say it's like Jackson Pollock, because he threw paint on the canvas. Mm-hmm. You don't throw it, you pour it.
I do, and I tend to throw. It depends on what I have.
Only
around
if you're
me.
Angry. If it's not working.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I just don't want to get paint splattered all over everything around me. But
right.
Usually. I start out with an idea, and I just try to be mindful of that idea while I'm doing everything, and I mix up my colors, and I start pouring. Sometimes I do sketches beforehand on the canvas, and so basically it's pouring, and then it dries for a couple of days, and I come back, and I pour some more, do a little brushwork. And sometimes I use my breath or an air compressor or a hairdryer. I've used toothpicks. So it really depends on what I'm doing, what I'm going for. But I try to keep that fluid, natural kind of continuity whenever it comes to.
So with the hairdryer, with your breath, you're actually mm-hmm. blowing the paint in mm-hmm. certain
well,
directions.
Well, the hairdryer, I'm trying to just dry the top layer so the bottom will crack. It's pretty complicated.
And where does that idea come from? Is this something that other people have done that you saw, or have you created this kind of?
Not that I know of. It's just been a work in progress, trial and error, lots of mistakes over the years.
Okay.
But actually, a local artist gave me the idea to heat the paint.
We'll come back and talk more about this in just a couple of seconds with Arthur Brothers and Kyle Mosher. All Hannah Blanton is also here from Sozo Gallery at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Birdhouse on the Greenway, creating habitats for birds and other wildlife by offering feeders, houses, and water features. Piper Glen next to Trader Joe's, bringing people and nature together. BirdhouseOnTheGreenway.com. And NS2 presenting the Pixies with special guest John Grant Tuesday, May 12th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. In the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, a look at the underlying causes of urban poverty and racial strife, how income disparity, government housing policies, and the decline in manufacturing affect the lives of African Americans in major U.S. cities. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're still talking about art, and if you'd like to join the conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can join us through Facebook or Twitter. Search for WFAE there. We're coming right back.
Advanced placement classes offer college credits to high school students if they do well enough on their AP exam.
If you're just plopping these kids into AP courses, they're not going to do well, and you may have to water it down so much that it's not going to really be considered a college-level course.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Question is, how do you get those kids ready? That's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about art today with two local artists, Arthur Brothers and Kyle Mosher. They're very different in what they do. Hannah Blanton is also with us. She's the owner of Sozo Gallery. She represents Arthur, as a matter of fact. I want to go back and talk a little more about this fluidity in your work, because you pour paint on the canvas, you blow it around, and it's kind of a style that you have developed yourself in a way. It also looks a little bit, and this is not meant to be deprecating, because it's not, but it looks like a little bit occasionally like spin art, what they used to do at the fairground, where they would pour paint and the thing with the canvas would spin.
Oh, yeah.
But yours is different because it's more controlled. It's not just haphazard. And some of it looks like a couple of pieces to me look like an extreme microscopic close up of cellular movement within the body. Is that intentional?
No. That's all subjective.
Okay. Well, that's the other thing, because you're very abstract. So, and you give your paintings titles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering where the titles come from. Do they come before you do the work, after you see what you've created? And how important are they? Because it seems to me that abstract art is in the mind of the beholder. It's what you want it to be. Mm-hmm. You see what you want to see.
Sure. Well, I start out with a thought or a mantra, and I just kind of go with that. And I just keep that
a mantra,
in mind.
For instance, give me a for instance.
Well, let's see. There's a piece that just sold at the gallery called Innate Luminosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that week I was just reading up a lot about different Buddhist practices.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one that I just kind of came across that I was really interested in. And it's kind of like the innate light that everybody has inside of them. And I just kept that in mind and started out with white. And then my dark colors went on top of that. And what I do is I mix the top colors a little harder. So I beat bubbles into them so that, you know, when those bubbles pop, if they do what they're supposed to do, then what's underneath them will show through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, there you have it.
You see, I have two questions. First of all, people who do what they do innately, and I think you probably do, even though you've worked at it and learned things over the years, it's innate in you. Is it hard to talk about? Is it difficult to put into words what, mm-hmm. what your process is? Because it's so part of you, you don't probably think about it very much.
That's why I think videos come in handy.
Yeah.
And when he talks about his process, are there things about it that you don't understand, or things about it that you can relate to the way you work, Kyle, and vice versa?
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of technique that he employs into his art, and there's definitely obviously technique that I employed in my art. So mm-hmm. he's got his thing down, and I have my thing down. But there are definitely things that I do subconsciously, or I don't even know. I'm like, oh, this is going to go here, and I don't even think about it anymore. So it's definitely, you know, part technique and mm-hmm. conscious awareness of what I'm doing, and there's parts where it's completely subconscious, where I'm just like, this is just what's happening.
You represent a lot of abstract art and artists in your gallery, and I'm curious what people say when they come in and look at it, and what you say to them about these pieces, because maybe you don't know everything about what the artist intended, but it's up on the wall and it's got a price tag on it. So
yes.
When you're asked to talk about it, what do you say?
That's part of it, is finding that connection. And it's really interesting when people come in, whether it's some of the top executive people here in Charlotte or some of our homeless friends that come in.
Mm-hmm.
It's really engaging in that art and studying it and then finding that connection. It's really fun seeing what different people read off of abstract art and what they can learn from it.
people sometimes look at abstract art and say, I could do that. But they really can't. And that's where the artist part comes in. I mean, they really can't. I mean, you could give them the cans of paint. You could be in your room where you work, both of you. Here are the newspaper clippings. Here's the paint. Here's the canvas. Have at it. And they will not be able to do it. So that's what makes it interesting, valuable, special. They can't hear a nod on the radio.
Yes, I'm sorry. That was to me. Yes. Like Arthur was saying, it's really a lot about your composition and your color technique. And, you know, we have a glass artist that says Carmela, who is incredible. And we have different types of artists with different textures and different mediums that have worked or studied this type of work for a long time. So it's not as easy as it looks.
Kyle, you've talked this morning about Picasso in interviews that I've seen. You've talked about Braque and Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns and Cezanne and Dadaism and synthetic cubism. These are things your average hockey player doesn't talk about.
Yeah.
So at what point did you learn about these people?
So when I was at the liberal arts school that I was at before I went to the fine arts school, I had art history 1 and 2. And quick story. So we were doing a review and I walked out of the class, right? So the teacher was like, she was angry, right? And I came back and I took the, I think I, it was the final review I think we were doing, and I got 115, right, on the final. Uh-huh. And she's like, she was angry, partly angry, but I'd always been really into it, but I never showed it or talked about it. But it was like, so I guess that the what I'm trying to say is that no one really knew, but I was deeply interested. When I was taking art history, I was really into it, and it was something that I really connected to. So, it was definitely, I can never really talk about it to my friends or obviously my teammates or my parents, but I had always been really keenly interested in art, definitely.
Wow.
So it was, yeah, definitely not your normal, I guess not your typical hockey player.
What do you think led each of you to the way you do it, to your techniques, to your approach to creativity? What led you to be so meticulous? Because you have to be meticulous, but artistic at the same time, and you have to be open to what happens. So what led you into these different approaches, for lack of a better word?
Arthur. I guess it's all about just starting with something and have that evolve.
I mean, you're from Charleston, and I was wondering about, because you're so close to the water down there, is this fluidity from living close to fluid?
Sure, some of it, absolutely.
And you're from the north, and we all know the north is screwed up.
Yeah. I'm a control freak when it comes to my art, so everything has to go my way, and I have a type A personality, so like, I have to make this.
Because it really is. You it's like typesetting almost.
Yeah.
It's meticulous.
Yeah. Which is again, ironic, because I'm like, anyone who knows me knows I'm very impatient. But when it comes to my art, I'm not, so it's weird.
Maybe it was your website that I saw the time-elapsed photograph of a gallery showing.
Is it
your work?
That was at Sozo.
Now, I have to ask you a question about this. I sat there, and it goes on for a long time. It's at least 4 or 5 minutes long. It's a time-elapsed thing, and it's very fast. It's people moving like super speed. And I've gone to a lot of gallery showings. I have to say that when I go, yeah, I have some of the wine and cheese, but I look at the art, and I kept watching these people for 2 or 3 minutes, and they were all talking to each other and going up to the bar and getting wine. Nobody was looking at the art. What's up with that? Does that frustrate you?
Maybe you
can only see it in the time lapse.
Yes.
Maybe you can't see it in real time.
I think that's it.
Okay.
Because people, they were looking. I remember explaining the art to people, but just they weren't spending as much time on the art as they were being social.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was more taking pictures and, you know, talking about the art. Because
that's kind of a sociological art piece, that time elapsed thing, because you see certain people gravitating towards certain people, and you know after about a minute of watching this in fast, super fast hyper time, you know that there are people who want to get away from those people, and they can't get away. But that's another story. That's another show. You use a lot of pop and rap stars in your work. Why?
I relate to their stories, and I obviously love the music, all music. But yeah, I relate to the story of just, you know, having this dream that everyone sees is crazy, and just putting your all into it and having no plan B and just kind of being reckless. And, you know, as a aspiring musician or artist, you have to be somewhat crazy and reckless. And I relate to the story. It's beautiful when people overcome odds and follow their dreams and achieve whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. So I relate to that story, but I also like to, you know, take the pop art approach of, you know, taking these hip hop artists or indie artists and putting my own spin on them and creating a stylized version of them in my art. So
now I haven't had the opportunity to get up close and personal with some of this, but I've seen pictures of these, like Kanye West's portrait on the web. And once again, you're using little fragments of newsprint in the background. And some of this, I'm assuming, is really old newsprint. Yeah. Is that deliberative to juxtapose somebody who's on the cutting edge of what's happening today with newsprint from 100 years ago that is completely unrelated to what's happening today? Is there a through line that you're trying to demonstrate there?
Well, initially it was purely aesthetic. I was really drawn to, again, synthetic cubism, and it was how to put my spin on it onto it using creating this signature style. And it started with the portraits, and it wasn't deliberate to create a juxtaposition, but you know, now it's obviously it's beautiful. You know, aesthetically, it's great. So you have this old, like you said, this old paper, and you know, again, trying to make it contemporary.
Mm. Both of you have tattoos on your arms. I have to mention this on your forearms and maybe elsewhere, but all I can see is the elbow down. You're artists. How do you choose the people you're going to allow to use you as their canvas? How do you choose those people?
Well, I started getting tattoos probably in my early 20s, mm-hmm. 20, 21. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, I had friends that did tattoos and I had some ideas. And, you know, I got some work done of some of my
Artists. Do you guide them? Or are you an over-the-shoulder backseat driver artist tattoo guy? I mean, do you tell them, not that color, not there? Or do you just let them do what they do?
It's pre-planned.
It's pre-planned?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I go in, you know, it's going to be on your body the rest of your life. So
right.
I make sure, I'm trying to find a tattoo artist here in Charlotte. Hey, guys, contact me. I'm trying to find one here. I've been here for a year and some change, and I still haven't found one that I can really connect to. But I have a lot more work that I'd like to be done.
And when you say connect, what does that mean?
Just, again, seeing their work and saying, hey, you know, you visually understand what my vision is, like mm-hmm. you understand it, and I trust you enough to put it on my body for the rest of my life.
Now, both of you are making a living at this, which is wonderful because that's something that's rare, actually, in any artistic endeavor to actually be able to feed yourself, house yourself, clothe yourself. What's the market like in this post-recessionary economy?
It really depends. You know, Hannah, she finds people that I feel like I would never come in contact with. And then I, you know, for me, it's more friends and family and people that I've sold art to over the years. So
back for more coming back.
Uh-huh. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. And occasionally I'll get emails or, Facebook messages from somebody, mm-hmm. From a random country. So it's all about, you know, marketing and putting yourself out there online, using those tools. 'Cause there's, you know, so many people in this world, but there's a lot of people that are suffering and they are having issues. But, you know, if you get yourself out there, then you have the people that aren't having the worst time. Right. You give them an easier way to get in touch with you.
How do you price it? How do you know where it is, what that price should be? Does the artist set that? Does the gallery owner set that? Does the marketplace set that? How does it work?
That's tricky.
Very
Anna?
Tricky.
I think it's a combination. We look at his work and where he's been selling it, and then the value that we put on it. And I don't know if you know this, Mike, but we price it per square inch. So it's a little method.
Is that industry standard? Is that how it works?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're getting a great big campus, it's going to obviously be more than just a small one.
Although I've seen sometimes we tweak it a little bit.
Now, you spoke, Kyle, with our Sarah Delia here at WFAE about licensing your work. I've never heard an artist talk about this before. You said licensing your artwork is huge. It allows you to retain the physical piece but then make multiple copies of it, and you get royalty checks every month. You sound like a music mogul here. I've never heard an artist talk like that.
A lot of the stuff, you know, that I learned, I've learned through music, and I said that, you know, if you ever hear me talk, it's like I'm greatly inspired by musicians, and I look at what they have done with their careers, and I've never marketed or kind of approached how I approach the business side of things as an artist. I always looked at how musicians did it, and I was like, wow, they can license their music. You probably could license your art. So I just did a ton of research. There's a book called The Artist and Designer's Market, and you look at the end of the book, and it has all of the industry contacts, you know, and it gets updated every year. So I spent months. I went through and highlighted all of the people that I was going to send my work to, and I spent months sending it out. And I got no, 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 no. But I was like, you know, eventually I'm going to get one yes. And that was the one yes I got, was Galaxy Graphics, and they're based out of New York City. And I create artwork exclusively for them, and they put it into retail settings, Michael's, Home Goods, anything under TJ Maxx, Walmart, eBay, Amazon. And that's where you get, you know, mass production of your work that's get royalties for every month.
It's amazing. Now, the question is, because there's always this battle between artistry and commercialism, how do the two, where do they meet, and what happens in that moment when they meet? And I have 30 seconds.
Oh, you definitely get, for me, it's pushback, absolutely pushback. Like, you're not a real artist, and it's a sellout, and whatever else, whatever negative spin people want to put on it. I think it's ridiculous, in my opinion, but.
Because you got to eat.
I mean, I get to make art all day long.
There you go.
That's awful. Wow.
Kyle Mosher is one of our guests, along with Arthur Brothers, both artists, both very different. You can see their work on their respective websites and on ours. And you can see Arthur's work at the Sozo Gallery. Hannah Blanton, the owner of that, with us as well. Thank you all for the hour. Interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.